My name is Paul Hain. This session is titled The Nation State, Some Skeptical Views. I have more trouble titling these sessions than I have in figuring out what to talk about. Whenever I put down a realistic title, it looks so boring that I'm afraid I'll show up here and there'll be nobody here. But this is, in planning the sessions that I've been allowed this week, I was aware of the fact that this weekend is the 4th of July, and it would be a good thing to reflect on government. And you might wonder, what right does an economist have to talk about government? Well, in the last 20 years or so, economists have done a lot of work on the theory of how governments operate. This has made some political scientists furious. They accuse economists of colonizing their discipline. But economics is getting into the field of political science, maybe messing it up, but I think achieving some insights. But what I really want to do is get you to think about some things to separate some things that we don't always separate. I want to get you thinking about all kinds of different words, and we'll see where it comes out. I want to say, first of all, that I am a matriot. Some people say patriot, but I'm a matriot. I'm an anarchist. I might as well confess that. I am a philosophical anarchist. I do accept a minimal state, but very minimal, and the less the better. Now, this is not a theological position. You are in no way required to hold it, but I just wanted to confess that. However, I am deeply grateful for the traditions that we celebrate on the 4th of July. And I think there is nothing wrong with being grateful for those traditions, and in that sense, patriotic, and being an anarchist. In fact, I suspect that the people who wrote the U.S. Constitution were very close to being anarchists themselves. But what I want you to do, you don't have to be an anarchist this evening, what I want you to do is begin by thinking about six terms that we tend to blur together, that I find my students blurring together and people with whom I talk. And as a result of blurring them together, using one when they mean another, I think we come out with a lot of strange conclusions. I submit that these six words refer to very different realities. People, you're all a people. There are lots of people. People are all different. And yet we often talk about the people, don't we? The people. What do we mean when we say the people? The people want. Do we mean all the people? A majority of the people? The people who count? What do we mean? Well, sometimes we mean society, but then we don't know what we mean by society either. I submit that we all belong to many societies. I belong to a church, that's a society. I belong to a Department of Economics, that's a society. My family is a society. The people here at Holden Village form a society. We belong to many, many societies. And so when we talk about the society, what are we talking about? Is there only one? Sometimes we pretend that there is. Community is a very hallowed word for me. Most societies to which I belong are not, as I see it, communities in any defensible sense of the word. Community, and of course there's something arbitrary about this, community refers to sharing, but for me a community has to be people who see one another face to face. The community, there's a real, if you don't genuinely hurt when another member of your, quote, community breaks his leg, then it's not a community. That's what I understand by community. Clearly, a lot of the societies to which we belong aren't communities. In fact, we belong to some societies, many of us, that we would like to see disrupted. Well, now, shifting over here, some different words. Nation. It's interesting, and one of the things that I want to just complain about, and I hope I make you suspicious about, is the way in which the word nation has taken over all of these other meanings. A nation is a group of people united by common language, a common culture, frequently a common geographic territory, but not always. We here in the United States are misled. See, if we lived in Europe, we would have a better experience of what nation means, because in Europe you have nations that aren't united by a common territory. You will have several nations within one state. Many of the problems of Europe have been caused by the fact that nations are not all under the same state. And of course, state is something very different from nation. The Germans are a nation, and there's been much dispute over how far that nation extends. Does it extend into Austria? Some thought in the late 1930s that it did. Some thought that it didn't. But there you have a common language, but some differences of culture. But the state has a tendency to claim the right to control the nation. And so the phrase nation state is often properly used to describe what I think is one of the truly demonic realities of our time. In part because, as I hope you will come to see, we have defined the state, after identifying it with the nation, in a way that unjustifiably absorbs all the rest of these. In fact, I think state is the great god among these. Increasingly, people are willing to concede to the state the absolute right to determine any disputed issue. Once the state has spoken, that's it. I'm just think for a moment about the United Nations. A lot of people think that the United Nations is a place where all the people of the world meet together, but I think it's important to notice that that's the place where representatives of nation states, or sometimes not even nation states, where representatives of states meet. And how often don't we just take for granted that once the state has spoken, that settles the issue? Think if any of these is trying to play God in our time, it's the state. A government seems to me to mean something quite different. Government is the coercive apparatus of the state. However, you may not agree with my definitions of these, and they aren't definitions. I'm just trying to point to different realities. So what do we mean when somebody says, for example, society has a moral obligation to do such and such? You hear that phrase, don't you? Society has a moral obligation to do something or the other. What do we mean? Can a society have a moral obligation? Can anything except individual human beings have moral obligations? I'm troubled by the idea that a collectivity can have a moral obligation. It seems to me to at least be problematic. But even then, the question is, which society? For example, if you say that society has an obligation to care for the unfortunate, which society are you talking about? Are you talking about the nation, the state, the government, some smaller community, or some particular society to which you belong? But what we usually do, don't we, when once we decide that the society has some kind of obligation, we then immediately jump to the conclusion that therefore we ought to pass a law. I want you to see how odd that leap is. The notion that a society has an obligation does not drive us to the conclusion, therefore we ought to pass a law. And I ponder a lot the question of why we are so quickly driven to that conclusion. And I think one of the reasons is that we have somehow bought the notion, it seems to me in the United States we bought the notion in the 1930s, that government, which is the ruling apparatus in which we identify with the state and identify with the nation and with the society and the will of the people and finally the community, as we glom those all together, And we assume that government is in the hands of a benevolent despot. Try this out. Do you believe that we've got pollution problems? There are pollution problems. Okay. Why do we have pollution problems? Well, why do you think? Why do we have pollution problems? Somebody want to?
Cars? Selfish companies.
Selfish companies? Selfish cars and selfish companies.
Lack of foresight.
Lack of foresight. Okay. I think you mean drivers. You don't really want to blame the cars, do you? Okay. All right.
All of our self-indulgences.
Self-indulgences. Okay. So that's a problem. So what are we going to do about it?
Pass a law.
I mean, we don't know what else to do. I mean, we've got it. Government must. Once we come to the conclusion that people living together create problems. They create social problems for all sorts of reasons. If the capitalist system is producing pollution, racism, sexism, anxiety, and so forth and so forth. I'm just picking that one. Then we must therefore get government to do something, and we forget that government is made up of people who are also busily driving cars, being selfish, who are full of racist prejudices and sexist prejudices and anxieties and everything else. This idea that there is somewhere an all-powerful and all-kind despot into whose ear we can whisper and say, hey, we have a problem, pass a law and solve it, I think intrigues us in some strange way.
Authority and to whom the people in the nation or in a society to whom they give authority, who they let have authority over them. So in our instance, government has authority. I don't see that touch, and I just wonder how that comes into it.
Well, government, okay. I want to do that in a moment. Lots of other institutions have authority over you, don't they? Are you saying, though, the government has some kind of unique authority?
Yeah, I would say kind of unique authority.
Okay. Well, let me just jump ahead, ask that question. Why does government have unique authority? Why do we say that? Why do we grant that?
Well, it can enforce its rules, but besides that, it protects us to a certain extent, helps us to live together in a civilized, quote-unquote, civilization.
So do our schools. Don't they?
That's a matter of debate.
Well, government's a matter of debate, too.
Okay.
Let me suggest something. Let me suggest something. Government is the one institution in society that is generally conceded an exclusive right to coerce adults. There are four terms that I want you to watch. It is generally conceded. There's some people who don't accept either this government or some who don't accept any government at all. But generally, people will agree, government has now an exclusive right. Only government has the right to coerce. And now, what do you mean by coerce? Well, I think coerce means to induce people to do what you want them to do by withdrawing an option from them. See, everyone has a right to persuade, which means to say, if you will do this, I will give you an extra option. But only government has the right to coerce, to say, if you don't do this, you will be deprived of your freedom and go to jail. When the United Way comes around to collect money, they plead with you, and they say, you'll feel good. Or something like that, an extra option. When the government comes around to collect money, they say, I don't care whether you feel good or not, you will go to prison if you don't. And then I would add the exclusive right to coerce adults, because many people grant that that others have the right to coerce children. But government has that exclusive right. And so, now notice, and I think this gets at the part of the problem. Are we perhaps overly enamored of coercion? We're intrigued with government. We tend to assign government all power, without thinking very carefully. We assume that government can solve all our problems because government has the right to coerce. And what has made us so suspicious of, impatient with, other means of securing cooperation? Why do we want to coerce people so quickly? I don't know the answers, but I am increasingly intrigued by the answer that Alexis de Tocqueville started to give back in the 1830s, and that a lot of people have picked up in recent years, that there is in this nation, and perhaps in other industrialized nations of the world, there are a whole lot of forces at work that are subverting intermediate institutions. And it's interesting to reflect on what those forces are. All of the other societies or communities have been weakened, almost fatally weakened in some cases. You know, like the church. For most people, you know, I love the sign on the bus that says, "Go to the church of your choice." The church of your choice. Well, you see, a church that you choose doesn't really command your loyalty, does it? It titillates you. You go to the church of your choice because that's the one where you feel most comfortable, most at home, the one that does the most for you. I almost think those signs ought to be changed to "Go to church this Sunday and worship the God of your choice." But why has the church become, in our society, such a, of course not for everybody, but for so many people, such a marginal institution? So that if you don't get your way, if you don't like the sermons, you quit. You know, if it doesn't please you, you quit. And other institutions, too. Look, how about, what other institutions are there? Neighborhoods, your neighbors. Your neighbor, a strong word, a powerful word. What is your neighbor? Someone that you usually don't know. You think his name is Bob. And why don't you know your neighbors? Well, because the way we live. Your neighbor communicates with his garage, through his garage to his house. And you don't need him. What do you need your neighbor for? And besides, we're moving all the time. Where are intermediate institutions in our society with some power? And so, well, de Tocqueville warned about this in the 1830s, and Robert Nisbet and a lot of other people are warning today. Michael Novak is another one who's warning about this, that all the mediating structures are being destroyed, and we are increasingly left with lonely individuals and Washington, D.C., the government of the nation state. And we go to the nation state and the government because we don't have any place else. Even when we gripe about it, even the people who call for less government to get government off our backs, you watch them. They only want government off that portion of their backs, which is making them uncomfortable. But they expect, for one thing, they expect government to take the initiative to get off their backs. They don't think that there's any way in which they can emancipate themselves or declare themselves free from the tyranny of the nation state. Yeah?
You haven't mentioned other societies or other places of power in the United States, at least where we live, and even in the world, such as IBM and Xerox and U.S. Steel and on and on. What about those companies and what about those guys in those corporate boardrooms who exercise tremendous power? The ones who have the steel factories that pollute, who argue, who have the powerful lobbies that in Washington, admittedly, where we've given them the power to make the laws to try and reduce the anti-pollution laws.
All right, how about the mafia and how about the unions?
Well,
I think when you were talking about why do we give the government so much power, is because somehow we feel that in electing the people to the government, they are the only ones who can control these other forces.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, you know, as far as the neighborhood and as far as the church, though I don't think those have been a force in this country ever, except maybe long ago when the Puritans first came, because or some of the other groups, because they had been persecuted in their countries and they wanted religious freedom. But somewhere along the line, and even in the Christian church, somewhere back with Constantine, And back there, the church made the assumption that they would have power by being close to power rather than being the power themselves. But I think the whole problem here, the thing that I see is there's an interesting relationship between we the people would rather give power to the government to control these other forces up here that we know we can't control.
Okay, well, I would just like to let that sit uneasily with the mafia and the unions. No, that's okay. I'm glad you brought that in. Some people are very worried about the power of IBM, and some are very worried about the power of unions.
I'm a shop steward, so I'm not anti-union.
But I want to try, if I can, to avoid right now, maybe till 8 o'clock, I'll avoid the problem of the power of these other things, because I want to get to something else in 5 minutes and then throw it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The way I think of government is trying to create, you know, some kind of order out of what could be chaos, but just as we ourselves try to order our life, there is also the tendency to be selfish and self-important and all this and that, and it's how do we keep the government from being that.
Okay. Yeah.
I'd like to come back to something you said. A few minutes ago you said, quote, everyone has the right to persuade. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Not in every society or government or minority.
I'm this country. I'm talking.
Okay, in this country. All right. Isn't it an essential of the state of our nation, or I'm not sure these terms, that if we hadn't had a philosophy started basically by people like Locke and Jefferson, that everyone should have some basic rights that the government should protect? And in that sense, the government can be a protector, not just a monster forcing us to do things we don't really want to do. It can have a positive side that some of us don't recognize.
Okay, I accept that. I do not believe, despite my opening statement that I'm an anarchist, I don't believe that government is totally useless. Let me push on and then come back to this. If you concede that, and I've got a lot of nods on this, that whatever the power of unions and IBM, they are not generally conceded the right to coerce. If IBM coerces, it's not supposed to be doing that. Now, there's a problem here, by the way, with my definition of coercion, my distinction between coercion and persuasion. I think it's a very useful distinction. I'd urge you to think about it. The proof is in the pudding. The notion that coercion is inducing people to cooperate by taking away an option from them, whereas persuasion is inducing people to cooperate by adding an additional option. I think that's very useful, but it can beg a question. You can't use it unless you know what options people have to begin with, what options they have a right to. For example, just to illustrate one case, suppose your employer says to you, Betsy, I want you to work the graveyard shift. You say, I don't want to. And he says, you've got to, or you're fired. And you say, I won't. He says, you're fired. You go out and look for another job. Now, was he practicing coercion or persuasion? And the answer depends on who you think has a right to the job. If you believe that if you believe that the job by right belongs to Betsy, maybe because she's had it for 10 years and has worked faithfully, and she has a kind of tenure, and then I think you would be correct in saying the employer has coerced her. But now change the situation. Suppose Betsy just started and the employer says, well, we haven't worked out your schedule yet. You're going to have to work the graveyard shift. She says, I don't want to work the graveyard shift. She says, well, I hired you on the assumption that you would. I would say then that he's trying to persuade her and she's turning it down. I mean, he's saying you can have this job if you're willing to work the graveyard shift or not. But it gets tricky and it really depends. I suspect that we can often, you know, overcome some shouting at one another and get closer to what it is that we're disagreeing about when we talk about coercion and power, because power isn't bad. Power is good. Power is what enables me to speak right now. Power is what enabled you to get to the dining hall. And power is what enabled you to get up from the dining hall table, come over here. Power is what enables us to love. We must be empowered. Power is a good thing. Coercion, I think, is a bad thing. But what is coercion? And I believe we can get a little closer sometimes to agreeing with one another, or at least stop shouting at one another so loudly, if we use this definition and recognize that everything hinges on what rights we think people begin with. But now, here's the issue that I want to throw at you, and in a funny way. If coercion is a bad thing, why use it? Why use it? Why not just use persuasion? And I think that there is one simple answer to that. And like all simple answers, it's too simple. But I submit that there is one basic reason for using coercion. And it is this: that in any large society, well, a society that gets beyond a certain very small size, people will not be able, or put this way, people will be able to dump the costs of their actions on other people. Or another way of putting it is, people will not be able to appropriate for themselves all of the benefits and will not be forced to bear on themselves all of the costs of the actions in which they engage. It's the problem, that isn't very clear to you, I can tell. The basic problem is the problem of free riders. Look, when you want a clean restaurant, how do you get one? You go into a clean restaurant. If you look and you see it's dirty, you walk out. You go to, you get the word after a while. You don't go in and say, ooh, it's dirty. Why don't you do that when you want clean air? If you want clean air, go someplace that's got clean air. And if the air is dirty, go someplace else. Well, the problem is, you see, that people who dirty their restaurants own the restaurant in a double sense. If they keep it clean, they get the benefits. If they let it get dirty, they bear the costs. But when you dirty the air, that doesn't happen. You can dirty the air and other people bear the costs. Now, you know, if you start thinking about it, you know, we do. Suppose your neighbor, now over there, your neighbor, last year your neighbor planted marigolds, and that was interesting. You loved those marigolds. You didn't do a thing about it. You appropriated the benefits of all of his labor. This year he's not planting marigolds. You say, drat, I wish he'd planted marigolds. They were so lovely last year. But you know what you can do? Because he is clearly in charge of that marigold plot, you could go over there and say, Harry, why don't you plant some marigolds? He says, oh, I don't have time. He says, well, let me help you. Or you can induce him. You can bribe him. And in fact, if you don't mind the word bribe, that's what we do. We secure an awful lot of cooperation. We get rid of a lot of bads. We acquire a lot of goods by paying these kinds of bribes. Even, one of my favorite examples is they're going to build an airport someplace, and so what happens is the airport authority buys up all the land underneath the approachways, and what are they going to do with all that land? Well, the answer is they sell it to people who don't mind living under noise. And in that way, those people are persuaded to accept the noise. That's kind of a way of handling pollution, isn't it? Businesses, for example, that aren't bothered by noise will buy that land, and in fact, if they like being close to the airport, that's a good deal for them. Or someone who is hard of hearing might find a real good real estate deal. I'm just trying to illustrate, there are an amazing number of ways we can do that, you know, in which we can get people to accept their own costs, or we can buy into deals, but there are limits because of the free rider problem. Because there are an awful lot of goodies that you can get even if you don't pay for them. And that, it seems to me, is the basic case for government, to overcome the free rider problem. Adam Smith, I always salute, said that the basic case for government was this, that there are an awful lot of goods that are very valuable to the society which will not be provided because it is not profitable to anybody to provide them. And the reason it's not profitable to anybody to provide them is because the person who provides them cannot appropriate the benefits from providing them. So suppose that I came up with a fantastic clean air scheme. I developed a gigantic solar-powered vacuum cleaner that sucks all the schnook out of the air and turns it into compost. who could I get to pay me for that? You say, well, everybody would pay you. They'd all be glad to have clean air. Yeah, sure. So I go around and I say, you want clean air, Neil? Yeah. How much are you willing to pay? And he said, wait a minute. It's a question. He asks himself a question. What's he asking me? Is he asking me, do I want the machine to be put in operation? Of course I do. So then he'll say, millions of dollars. But if he thinks he's going to be made to pay the value of it to him, you say, oh, gee, I don't care about clean air, 5 cents. And this is the way we behave. When we're asked that question, how much do you want this? And we think the payments will be distributed over the whole society, we put our value very, very high. When we think we're going to be made to pay it, we put it very, very low. Now, if you think about it, the problems of pollution, crime, fast driving on drag strips, I can turn every social problem into an instance of free rider behavior. Mm-hmm. That shows how crude I am.
So I don't understand how you...
Let me. There's some problems with that. There's some difficulties with that one that are going to get me hung up. Can I try a different one? You talked about justice. Can I try the one of aid to low income people, welfare?
That already involves money, because some of these just don't necessarily involve.
Yeah, but you see, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get away from the problem that people disagree sharply on what justice is. I want to come to that at the end and throw that open. But I think when you start talking about legislation to overcome racism and sexism, as soon as you get specific, you're going to find that there is no consensus in this society about what legislation is in order.
Okay.
That's the problem.
Okay, I'll wait if you don't answer.
Well, no, but I didn't want to use that example for that reason.
It's the philosophy of you can't really legislate morals.
Well, I think in a way you can, though. That's the problem. You can legislate behavior, and it's funny how behavior changes morals. Like, take the Supreme Court's decision in 1954 with respect to school desegregation. That was legislation. It was judicial legislation. And that changed behavior. And as people's behavior changed, their attitudes changed, their values changed. The automobile has changed morality, hasn't it? By making it possible for people to behave in a way that many of them wanted to behave anyway but found it too difficult to behave. It changed our patterns of behavior and then our accepted patterns of behavior. When everybody is doing it, you remember how, I'm sure there's some of you here who've had a son or a daughter who was not married to that person with whom they lived, and then grandpa and grandma came to visit and you had to, but that is getting to be more accepted, isn't it? It's getting accepted because it's happening. And in that strange sense, it is possible to legislate morality. But I'm
interested in that example you said you were going to use just now.
All right, let me go back to my script, and then you can go anywhere you want to. Because I hope it hooks with your question, maybe with yours. Look, I said that the case for government is the free rider problem, and I hope you see now that government is subject to the free rider problem itself. The basic trouble with government, we invoke government to overcome the free rider problem, and we don't notice that the democratic political process is subject to the same problem. We all want competent legislators, but how hard do you work? How many costs do you incur to find out who's competent? Why don't we do that? It's not because, you know, I hear somebody say something, you know, people will spend more time investigating a new toaster they're going to buy than they will investigating the person for whom they're going to vote in the legislature. You say, that is irrational. It's not. It's rational. Because you are in complete control of the toaster decision, and you have no significant impact on the legislator decision. You know, I have a friend who made this example beautifully. I think quoted this once before. He teaches at the agricultural economics department. He says the students who come here want to be farmers, and the most important thing for them is the weather. They never study it. They don't study the most important factor. Why? Because they know they have no control over it. See, so what we all do is we vote, but we really don't get informed.
And how in the world do we expect a whole bunch of ninnies going to the polls to choose wisely? And we don't. But now what happens, and here's the problem, is that whenever the issue matters enough and you think you can have an impact, you do get informed and you do lobby. The result of this is that our policies, government tends to be controlled by a succession of special interests. And that's the way the democratic political process works. And it's another instance of the free rider problem. It's the reason that, though every economist has always insisted that imports are good and exports are costly, every government in the world struggles to keep out imports and to encourage exports. That's because governments are dominated by producer interests. And the reason is that when the producers want, well, when the producers of automobiles want to sell more automobiles, GM and Ford and Chrysler and the UAW were well represented in Washington, and they knew where the legislators were standing or sitting or shuffling. But the people who buy Toyotas or Datsuns, you know, the interest is too small. We haven't got time to go to Washington, so we're not heard. This is the basic problem of government. It's designed to overcome the free rider problem, and it is itself subject to the free rider problem. And it bothers me deeply. This is one of the reasons that I am so unhappy with the nation state, that in the name of the public interest, and indeed even in the name of social justice, all sorts, and I always have problems with these quotation marks, every group in the country that wants the rest of the citizens to subsidize their special claim claims to be getting this in the name of social justice. You can't mention an issue for which I can't construct a plausible social justice argument. Chrysler, for example, why does Chrysler want a bailout?
Jobs
for the struggling automobile workers of Detroit. Right. And well, it's distressing, but we Americans, we love our country. We like the way it was founded, rang the Liberty Bell and all that. We feel loyal, patriotic. We get all of these things mixed up together. we feel that we ought to support the government and what the government does. But what is the government doing? And we think the government is tending the public interest. But in fact, the government is tending a succession of special interests. Is there a solution to it? I used to think there was. I now know that there isn't. I used to think that the solution was for us all to admit that there is no benevolent despot, all wise and all powerful, not even the majority. The majority has no right to do anything it wants to do, although I still think it's true that the majority does not have the right to do everything it wants to do. I used to think that the solution was for us all to draw back and agree that coercion is never warranted except on behalf of a genuinely public good, something that we all or almost all want but can't obtain because of the free rider problem. I see, I used to think that. I used to think that if we would just forswear all special interests and agree that it is illegitimate for government to do anything, to use coercion, that is, to provide any good unless really we all or almost all want it, that we could stop this capture of government by special interests. There are two issues now that I think show what's wrong with that. National defense and welfare. National defense and welfare are both instances of public goods. The problem is that about half of the people in the country think one is not a good, and the other half think the other's not a good. But you see, national defense is something that you can't have unless everybody has it. There's no way that the government can defend your hearth and home without defending your neighbor's hearth and home. So if you try to provide national defense through the market, you won't get any provided. Now, some people say, hey, that's a pretty good scheme. and maybe there's something to be said for it. I think that turns out to be one of the strongest arguments against the draft. But welfare is another instance, I think, of a public good. Although here I find polls show that the great majority of Americans believe that governments acting on behalf of society ought to provide some kind of minimum level of living for people who cannot otherwise make it. And so government, what you might ask, well, why do we have to do this through coercion? If almost everybody believes this, why don't we all contribute? And the answer is because almost all of us are only willing to contribute on the condition that others contribute too. And so that requires coercion. But the trouble is, as soon as you induce coercion, then what government begins to do in its so-called welfare programs is not just provide this safety net for the poor, but it begins providing, in the name of feeding the hungry, it provides subsidies to the farmers. In the name of educating the poor, it provides subsidies and special privileges to the teachers. Right on down the line. You cannot find, I submit, a significant and long-enduring welfare program that is not significantly serving some special and quite undeserving interest.
Food stamps.
How well is it doing? How well is the food stamp doing? Program doing?
Aside from the fact that it has addressed itself very largely to lower middle income, which is really taking an awful lot of the tax by, it really does help a great many people. And only recently has it restricted the students, because that was one of the great gripes, right or wrong, it was one of the great gripes. Yes, it helps government, it maintains order, it helps people from being hungry. It helps the agriculture department, agriculture in general. It has a, that's, you know, you said give you one program. That's a program I think might be one to talk about.
Okay. I was intending to throw it open at that point. And I have the terrible feeling that this has been an extremely muddled presentation. I blame you for getting me off
the track.
let me try to sharpen the question that I hoped we would come out with. It isn't even clear in my own mind. I want to ask you, why do we practice coercion? And I say, well, because a lot of things that we believe are necessary for the society would not or could not otherwise be provided. But coercion, it turns out, in a democratic political process, doesn't get us what we wanted to get from coercion, which is public goods, goods that benefit everybody, but which a private producer would have no incentive to provide. Instead, what happens is government gets captured by special interests. Is there a way out of this?
One way we have successfully used coercion is through lawsuits. There's been a tremendous rise in the last 15 years in private lawsuits for damages, mostly tort claims arising out of accidents or some of the kinds of wrongs that have been done to us. And I think that that's a way in which private citizens have figured out they can use the coercive police power of the state to enforce their private wrongs.
How much justice is there, though, in many of those lawsuits? When you get done with it and it's settled and the claim is made, how much justice is there really in many of those suits?
Well, I don't think there's any justice in a claim for millions of dollars for pain and suffering. I think that's completely bogus.
Yeah.
And it happens all the time.
You're not suggesting that people ought not to be allowed to sue for damages, are you?
No. I don't suggest that. My problem is that private citizens have figured out a way to use the coercive power of the state to enforce their own selfish gain. I mean, you can find a lawyer who can invent a cause of action for you to sue. And it isn't the lawyer's problem. It starts with clients who want to press a suit that's basically on very muddled ground. But I'm just suggesting that that's a kind of anonymous coercion that private citizens have figured out how to use in the last few years. And the reason I say anonymous is because I think that's why coercion is used more and more, is it takes us out of the realm of dealing person to person in an intermediate, peaceful way through those intermediate institutions, and takes us away from conflict, puts it in an objective, cold court setting, and the lawyers do it, we stay out of it and just cash in.
An interesting confirmation of that is the statements that I've frequently read that the doctors who get malpractice suits are not the doctors whose medical practice is poorest, but the doctors who do not establish a personal relationship with their patients.
Paul, I was just trying to think here if there were some public goods that we would desire and for which we would turn to government, because it does in fact have the power of coercion to enforce them, which aren't captured by public interest groups. Am I got your thesis right, that these public interest groups, which essentially capture government,
partial interest groups.
Well, would that be the case? I mean, I think, for example, the division of public education.
Yeah.
We look to government. It's not always centered in the nation state. It can be different kinds of jurisdictions, whether it's state or county or whatever. That's still government, and it has the power of enforcement. Wouldn't public education be an example of a public good which wouldn't, I mean, I can think of examples where that's captured by private interest groups, but I'm not sure it falls in the same category.
Well,
others you're talking about, or a post office.
Let me just take that one, will you?
Because mail around or some such thing like that. How do you communicate in society? Well, one way you do it is through the mail system. I might complain about the mail system, but isn't that an example of a public good that isn't captured by private interests and that still forces us? I mean, we have to pay so much for taxes for the education or...
Well, okay, I want to answer. I think those are both originally public goods, and they have ceased to be that. I think the schools, public schools, have been captured by private interests, and they're terrible as a result. There's some exceptions, of course. But we are, I think the public schools, I wonder whether the public schools aren't doing more harm than good. But how can you change them? It's absolutely impossible. The teachers' unions have got control now. It's impossible to do anything with the public schools in Seattle. The best teachers are laid off, and seniority rules, and I don't know, this is an issue which I'm deeply convinced that we are being very badly served indeed. We started off with the notion that we all have an interest in the youngsters being educated, and in fact, if we just let people pursue their interests up to the point at which they're willing to pay, people won't be educated enough. There's these spillover benefits. People will behave like free riders and get only that much education which is in their own interest. They won't get that amount which is in the interest of the total society. So we'll subsidize them. A very ancient and honorable idea. John Stuart Mill said he thought that government ought to make sure that facilities were available for everybody and then require education. But what we've done, he warned, do not allow the government to acquire a monopoly of it. And that's what we've done. And it's so terribly difficult to introduce any kind of meaningful change in the public school system because it's in the hands of a monopolist. And I think the post office is the same thing. I'm just astonished. I feel like Clarence Darrow with some crazy debate. The Lord has delivered him into my hand. How can you cite the post office?
Now, it seems to me that your argument is to use examples in our society where you've got that kind of breakdown, but you generalize to the point that it's government, or to use the other terms, that nation states inevitably result in this kind of thing. Now, wouldn't that argument be refuted if you could think of a society where public education was provided for and went reasonably well for decade after decade, and was in the hands of government? Wouldn't that be a reputation, rather than picking one in which it is in fact broken down?
Okay. Look, I am not trying to say that inevitably, always, and everywhere, anything the government does breaks down. I'm suggesting that in our time, we have gone much too far in the use of coercion we have gone beyond the limits of its effectiveness. What has happened is that the apparatus of coercion, which was justified originally as a way of providing to the public goods that otherwise could not be provided, that that apparatus has, to a very disturbing extent, in the United States, been captured by special interests.
Yeah, I don't
and you don't agree with that?
No, I don't disagree with that.
No.
I don't disagree.
And it seems to me it's a trend that is not going down but going up.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I guess where I might have some differences, I just don't basically disagree with that. I think that the reason we resort to that is because we, and you've already touched on it, it gets results, at least in the short term, and we're attracted to those results. It's the same reason why people take recourse to violence. It may be irrational in any long haul, but you'll do it because you get short-term results. But I also think that people take recourse to government and the nation state because they can't find another way, or at least do not perceive that they can find another way to secure public goods on a grand scale. And they have to go apart from that which is face-to-face. I mean, the reason the push for the Civil Rights Act by blacks in the southern states was because at local levels they could not secure something which was supposedly guaranteed to them as citizens. So they had to reach to a more central and higher authority backed by more force to make the appeal there and to the courts, etc., etc. The face-to-face relationships, the small communities, the immediate societies were not the place where they could get that kind of justice. And so they had to go to a very large and impersonal, by contrast, source that had the power of coercion.
Yeah.
Larry, you're
taking the conversation away to what I think is a very untypical issue, but this is common. It's common to talk about issues of racial justice, and I think they are not typical of the things that government does. I submit that what government typically does is help the morticians, the bricklayers. government is at its usual activity when it is keeping Japanese automobiles out, when it is restricting competition, when it's providing special privileges for vocational and occupational groups by using the apparatus of coercion to deny others the right to compete. Now, we've got, and by talking about issues of racial justice, you're getting into, of course, very important issues, but I think they are the kinds of issues that divert attention. Well, they are the kinds of issues I think divert attention to what I believe the problem is. I'm not terribly concerned about what government has done in the area of securing racial justice. Not because it isn't important, because I don't think we've got the pathology working there. I think the pathology is more typically working in a case like this. We had the thalidomide disaster, and we said, gee whiz, we've got to have safer drugs. So we say we will ask the government to make sure all drugs are safe. So we have a commission, well, fortunately we had one, the Food and Drug Administration. What it was going to do was be more careful, require more testing, hold drugs off the market longer. What a lot of people have not noticed, and this has now been well documented, that the FDA is forcing manufacturers to test drugs so long that the lives lost through delay are now greater than the lives saved. Why is it doing this? It's doing it because the apparatus will operate in its own interests, because the people who are responsible for protecting us from another thalidomide disaster, the ceiling will cave in if they let a thalidomide through. They will get the blame for that, so they're going to be super, super cautious. And in their own interests, they are going to cause a lot of suffering and death. Now, I picked that example because there are no wicked people responsible for it. But I think that is the paradigm case. We try to solve problems by turning them over to government in the belief that there are some benevolent despots there, some people who know everything and are good, or somehow if we can elect the right people. And that's not the way it works. But one thing we are left with, this is what troubles me, we're left with coercion. We're left with an expansion of the apparatus of coercion. More and more areas of our life are taken out of the realm where community can even touch them. As this organization, which I think is largely ineffective, at the margin now, it's pushed far, far too far. It's doing much more damage than good. But we're continuing to go to it for solutions. And it's not only the evil that it's doing, the injustices that it's perpetrating, but it is also the fact that it is sapping the energies of other societies, other communities. It is, that's what I was trying to, but it's 8 o'clock. If I'd been clearer in my presentation, you wouldn't be so confused now. Betsy, you get the last word.
It's imperfect, but can you think of a viable alternative?
No. What I'm urging us to do is look at it with matriotism, with love of our country. Notice the word country isn't up there. With love of the societies in which we live and the societies that have shaped us and the institutions, the constitution that we have inherited and all of our traditions, with love for this and respect for it, but not with idolatry. It's got serious, serious bugs.